This is an Australian Museum podcast. Welcome to Live Talks at the AM, recorded in front of a live audience at the Australian Museum in Sydney.
Can I start by acknowledging that we're meeting today on Gadigal land and pay respect to elders past and present? My name is Russell Briggs. I'm the Chief Experience Officer here at the museum. It's the best job in the world. We've had so much fun having the Ramses exhibition here, and the biggest and most special part of it is the public program that we've been able to offer just by having the interest in the exhibition. How many people here have been down to see the show already? Oh my gosh, that's fantastic. That looks like about 85 to 90%. Good, because we're going to go into some real detail today about it. So it's sort of perfect timing. The just going to find my notes here. The exhibition itself has been incredibly popular. We're sitting at about 450,000 people have been through the exhibition so far. We've got 3 weeks left, so we're pretty sure we're going to get over 500,000 people through, which is really exciting for us. It'll be the largest exhibition in terms of attendance that this museum has had in its almost 200-year history. So that's very exciting. It shows how many people really love Egyptian culture and the sense of mystery and interest that it has provided. And I'm not sure if people quite remember this, but the exhibition hall that Ramses is showing in right now was actually built for the Tutankhamun exhibition that was supposed to come here. And we were so lucky that the government provided the funding to be able to build it, and everything was based on the idea of Tut coming to this museum. And of course, COVID ended that. It was locked up in London. I was lucky to see it 1 week before everything locked down and then scampered back to Australia in time. But I can tell you that the Ramses exhibition is much better than that Tut exhibition was. The quality of the objects, the quality of the presentation, and the concepts themselves are far superior. So we're really lucky to be able to have that. And then equally lucky to be able to go into these kind of deep dives in some of the subject areas. So what we're going to do today is we're going to have about a 40-minute talk, and we'll introduce that in one moment. And then following the presentation, we'll sit down over here. I'll return up to the stage, and we'll do a Q&A based on some of the subject matter that's presented this morning. I do want to note that we're recording the audio from this morning's, the lecture and the Q&A, so if you don't want to be part of that, you don't have to ask any questions. So without further ado, let me introduce Honorary Associate Professor Boyo Okinga, and I'll just say a couple of words. So after completing his doctorate in Egyptology at the University of Tübingen in Germany, Boyo Okinga took up a position at Macquarie University in 1984, where he taught ancient Egyptian language, religion, and history. As an honorary associate professor in the Department of History and Archaeology and member of the Australian Center for Egyptology at Macquarie University, he now focuses on research, continuing projects in Egypt, excavating and publishing the inscriptions and iconography and tombs of the New Kingdom. And hopefully he'll tell us about some of the digs and some of the places he's actively involved in right now when we bring him up. And I should note that this entire program has been made possible in partnership with Macquarie University. So we're really lucky that we've been able to partner with Macquarie and that we're having one of the great honorary professors from Macquarie speak with us today. So most of you have been down in the exhibition, you'll notice that the Battle of Kadesh is a really main part of the whole thing. And they spend a lot of time explaining what happened and explaining how important it was in history. And I don't know about you, but I've been to the exhibition about 150 times. Every single time I've been down there, I've walked away feeling like I didn't get the whole story. There's always one point of view presented there, and I'm not exactly sure that's the actuality of the history. And it's slightly niggled at me the entire time the exhibition has been on. So I'm extremely excited to bring Professor Okinga up to talk about what really might have happened, or what the different sort of modes of interpretation of that essential point of history was. So that's what we're going to talk about today, and I'd like to now welcome Professor Okinga to the stage. Thank you.
Thanks very much for that introduction. And I'd like to congratulate the Australian Museum too on this fantastic exhibition. We only just got back from Egypt fairly recently, so I haven't had a chance to look at the exhibition until this morning prior to the talk, and it really is excellent, fantastic. We're very lucky to have the opportunity to see something like that here in Sydney. Well, let's see, when one deals with Ramesses II, one really needs to get used to superlatives. And this is something that the title of works that deal with him often reflect. Some of the more recent works in English on Ramesses are Kitchen's Pharaoh Triumphant, or Peter Brand's most recent book on Ramesses, Ramesses II, Egypt's Ultimate Pharaoh, or Joyce Tillesley wrote a book on Ramesses entitled Ramesses, Egypt's Greatest Pharaoh. He would, of course, been very gratified by all of this, and it's particularly as a successful warrior pharaoh that he would have been wanted to be remembered. Compositions like the one that you see here on the screen, with him riding in his chariot over fallen and fleeing enemies, are the most publicly projected images that we have of Ramesses II. In this, of course, he was not really any different from most New Kingdom kings, who are justifiably often referred to as warrior pharaohs. But what does distinguish Ramesses from the other warrior pharaohs of the New Kingdom is his focus on one particular battle, the Battle of Kadesh. It's certainly the best documented ancient Egyptian battle and probably one of the best documented battles of the ancient world in general. It's recorded on temple walls in text and image. For example, just one example of a temple, the west face of the first pylon of Ramesses' memorial temple, the Ramesseum. As if this huge representation in the Ramesseum wasn't enough, it's also recorded in the Ramesseum on the west wall of the second pylon of the temple. It's known not just from monumental records, but also from papyri. Copies of the text are preserved on papyri, for example, in the form of the so-called Poem of Pentawer. Pentawer was the scribe who wrote the copy of the papyrus, on papyrus Chester Beatty, now in the British Museum. As well as the textual record on the temple walls, we also have a very detailed pictorial record that records and preserves many interesting details. One of my favorite details is the one that you see here in the screen of the ruler of Aleppo being held upside down and emptied of the water he'd swallowed when fleeing from Ramesses across the Orontes River. The caption above the representation describes what's happening. The despicable ruler of Aleppo being emptied of water by his troops after his majesty had thrown him into the water. The question that I want to examine here today, though, is, was the Battle of Kadesh really such a great triumph for Ramesses II, or was it a disaster? As we'll see, the answer is not really straightforward. Now, Kadesh is located in modern-day Syria, in part of the world that at the time was disputed by the great powers. It lies at the northern end of the territory that Egypt claimed in Syria, Canaan, in the region where, in the earlier New Kingdom, it met the kingdom of its great adversary, Mitanni, and then later in the post-Amarna period, the kingdom of the Hittites. The Egyptians had controlled Kadesh since it was taken by one of Ramesses' predecessors, Thutmose III, around about 1450 BCE. In the Amarna period, Egypt lost control of Kadesh to the Hittites. Then In the post-Amarna period, Ramesses' father, Seti I, was briefly able to regain it, but it reverted to Hittite control. And this was something that Ramesses II decided that he was going to reverse and to regain it for Egypt. So in year 5 of his reign, around 1274 BCE, he led an Egyptian force northward to achieve that aim. He advanced with the four divisions of the army that were named after the four main gods of Egypt, the divisions of Amun, Ra, Ptah, and Seth, up the coast to Tyre, and then up the Litani River to meet the Orontes, and then up to Kadesh. But there was a very important additional component to his forces, a fifth division, referred to in the text as the Na'arin. These seem to be young, sort of crack troops, and we'll hear more about them later on. And this division was sent up the coastal road, further north along the coast, to then turn eastwards at the Nahr el Kalb and join the main Egyptian force marching across from the west. Kadesh is known today as Tel Nebi Mend, and it lies where the tributary Bahr el Mukaddiya runs into the Orontes. So the Tel is naturally surrounded by water on three sides, on the north, east, and west. And the Egyptian reliefs suggest that it was in fact completely surrounded by water, implying the existence of an artificial channel that joined the two rivers south of the city. We visited Kadesh in 2009, just before the dreadful war in Syria, and we were quite surprised to see the Orontes and the Tel el-Mukaddiya. When you read the inscriptions of Ramesses and look at the reliefs and so forth, you think of things on a grand scale with a huge river, but when you actually go there, it's a very modest little stream, nothing like what you'd expect the Orontes to be actually like. The Tel el-Mukaddiya is also quite a small stream as well. It wouldn't have been that difficult to get across it, I shouldn't have thought. Well, to get back to Ramesses, shortly before reaching Kadesh at a place called Shabtuna, a decisive event occurred that's described as follows in one of the literary records of the battle, the so-called bulletin. Then two Shasu of the tribes of Shasu came to say to His Majesty, "Our brothers, who are chiefs of tribes with the enemy of Khati, have sent us to His Majesty to say that we will be servants of Pharaoh and will abandon the chief of Khati." His Majesty said to them, "Where are they, your brothers, who sent you to tell this matter to His Majesty?" They said to His Majesty, "They are where the vile chief of Khati is. For the enemy of Khati is in the land of Aleppo, to the north of Tunip. He was too frightened of Pharaoh to come southward when he heard that Pharaoh had come northward." Now, these two men that the Egyptians were speaking to and who gave this report to Pharaoh were, of course, planted there by the Hittites to fool the Egyptians. Aleppo is 150 kilometers north of Kadesh, a long way away. So Ramesses was lulled into a sort of a false sense of security and thought that he could now comfortably move his forces north and set up camp in front of Kadesh. And that's exactly what he did. He continued marching northward, crossed the Orontes and the Bahr el-Mukaddiya to set up his camp to the west of Kadesh. The reliefs depict all sorts of interesting little details taking place in the camp. For example, dealing with a recalcitrant donkey, or keeping in check the king's lion who accompanied him into battle. But as Ramesses was settling down, things began to unravel. Again, the words of the Egyptian text, which describes what's happening in the reliefs. "Then a scout who was with His Majesty's retinue came, bringing two scouts of the enemy from Khati." So they captured these Hittite sort of scouts. "When they had been brought into the presence, His Majesty said to them, 'Who are you?' They said, 'We belong to the chief of Khati. "It is he who sent us to observe where his majesty is." His majesty said to them, "Where is he, the enemy from Kharti? I have heard he's in the land of Aleppo to the north of Tunip." They said to his majesty, "Look, the miserable chief of Kharti has come together with the many countries who are with him, whom he's brought with him as allies." And then we have a list of all these countries. The land of Dardani, the land of Naharin, that of Keshkesh, those of Massa, those of Pidasa, the land of Karkisha and Luka, the land of Carchemish, the land of Arzawa, the land of Ugarit, that of Irun, the land of Inessa, Mushanet, Kadesh, Aleppo, and the entire land of Kedi, a huge coalition that the Hittites had gathered together. They're equipped with their infantry and their chariotry and with their weapons of war. They're more numerous than the sands of the shores. Look, they stand equipped and ready to fight behind Kadesh the Old. Well, this is an absolutely disastrous report, and of course the Egyptians only got it out of the Hittites by beating them and forcing them to divulge this information. And as he received this disastrous report, disaster struck. The Hittites launched an assault, smashing through the division of Ra and attacking the Egyptian camp, while the division of Seth and Ptah was still some distance away to the south. The vizier was sent to hurry on the other divisions of the army that were still moving up from the south. And this is something that the reliefs illustrate. Whereas Ramesses jumped into his chariot and mounted a counterattack. The reliefs suggest that he was alone in his chariot. In fact, the texts tell us that he was accompanied by his shield bearer, a man called Mena. He was with him, and Mena wasn't too happy with what the king was planning to do. And the text actually informs us of this in the words of the king himself. Now when Mena, my shield bearer, saw that a huge number of chariots hemmed me in, he was dismayed. His heart sank, and stark fear possessed his body. Then he said to his majesty, "My good lord, mighty ruler, great protector of Egypt on the day of battle, we stand alone in the midst of the foe. See, the troops and chariotry have abandoned us." So this is something we find again and again being stated in the records, that Ramesses was abandoned by his army and left to fight off the Hittites all by himself. "Why do you stay to save them? Get clear. Save us, O Usamara Setabenra." Then his majesty said to his shield bearer, "Be firm, be bold hearted, my shield bearer. I shall go into them like the pounce of a falcon, killing, slaughtering, felling to the ground. What are these effeminate weaklings to you, for millions of whom I care nothing?" As things got rather precarious for Ramesses, he appealed for help to his divine father, the state god Amun. "What is this, Father Amun? Is it right for a father to ignore his son? Are my deeds a matter for you to ignore? Do I not walk and stand at your word? I have not neglected an order that you gave. Too great is he, the great lord of Egypt, to allow aliens to step on his path. What are these Asiatics to you, O Amun, the wretches ignorant of God? Have I not made for you many great monuments?" And then he goes on and lists all the works that he'd performed for his father Amun. And he goes on to say, "Do good to him who counts on you, then one will serve you with a loving heart." So he basically says, "You know, I've done all these things for you. It's now time for you to, you know, sort of repay the debt." And then he recounts, "Now, though I prayed in the distant land, my voice resounded in distant Heliopolis." Heliopolis, of course, was the city of the sun god Ra in the north of Egypt. And at this time, Amun and Ra were really one and the same god. "I found Amun came when I called to him. He gave me his hand, and I rejoiced. He called from behind, as if nearby, 'Forward, I am with you. I, your father, my hand is with you. I prevail over 100,000 men. I am Lord of victory, lover of valor. And it was at this point that something occurred which Ramesses interpreted as a miracle and as an answer to the prayer that he sent up to his father, Amun. The Na'arin, remember, these crack young troops who'd been marching up the Mediterranean coast, suddenly appeared on the scene at the crucial moment and joined in the battle. The literary accounts of the battle don't record this very decisive turn of events, but the reliefs and the captions to the reliefs do. For example, in the reliefs from the Temple of Luxor, we see them there at the extreme right, marching up to join Ramesses, and the inscription that's carved in front of them tells us what's going on. The arrival of the Na'arin force of Pharaoh from the land of Amuru. They found that the hostile ranks of the fallen ones of Hati had hemmed in the camp of Pharaoh while his majesty sat alone without his army being with him. Again, this emphasis on the king being alone. The army of Amun, where Pharaoh was, had not yet finished pitching camp, and the army of Ra and Ptah was still marching. The timely arrival of the Na'arin turned the tide of battle, and what would have been a total disaster, which could even have resulted in the death or at best the capture of the king, was averted. Even though Ramesses claims the Hittite king Muwatallis sued for peace, the battle was, in reality, a stalemate. He was able to regroup his forces and return to Egypt. Tactically, the battle may have been a stalemate, but strategically it was actually a defeat for Ramesses. He failed in his aims, namely to regain control over Kadesh and its territory. And we know this from the line of the border that was concluded after the famous peace treaty that you'll hear more about from my colleague Camilla de Biasi Dyson in a few weeks' time. The peace treaty that was concluded by Ramesses and his Hittite successor Muwatallis, the successor of Muwatallis, Hattusilis. And from the text of the Hittite treaty, it's quite clear that the Egyptian boundary was now established further south of Kadesh. So Egypt lost control of Kadesh forever, that remained in the sphere of control of the Hittites. Yet Ramesses acted as though this was a great victory. He had it recorded on a monumental scale in text and image on the outer walls of all the major temples of Egypt. On the outer walls, of course, because those are the ones that everyone can see. The temples that preserve a record of the Battle of Kadesh are found in Abydos, in Karnak. In Karnak, it's even recorded in three different places. In Luxor, where it's recorded in four different places. In the Ramesseum, where it's recorded in two different places. And in Abu Simbel. And of course, if we had more of these major temples still standing from the New Kingdom, I'm pretty sure that we'd have records of the battle there as well. So in Memphis, for example, the administrative capital of Egypt and where the king resided, or in the city of Ramesses that he built in the Eastern Delta, the temples there would also have been inscribed and carved with a record of his battle. And as we've seen, there are also papyrus copies of the text as well. It's the most extensively recorded ancient Egyptian battle. It can't all be false propaganda. So it's not as though he was just putting out lies into the world. Because remember, there were thousands of Egyptian troops who'd witnessed what had happened and who came home and who would have spoken about it as well when they returned to Egypt. So is it just vainglorious, empty boasting by a megalomaniac, which is the way that some people have interpreted this record that Ramesses left us? But to properly understand what's going on, we really need to place it all in its cultural context. In Egypt, after the Amarna period, the period that's identified with the so-called heretic king Akhenaten, who did away with all the other gods and only focused on the worship of the one god, the Aten. We have evidence that indicates that at this time the ancient Egyptians began to see events in their lives, and particularly remarkable, unique events in their lives, as being the result of the direct intervention of the divine, of the gods in their lives. And in situations of danger and difficulty, they appealed to the gods for help. We can see this very nicely in the modest monument of a man called Patawerit. On his stele, which is now in the British Museum, we have in three registers some fairly crucial events that took place in his life. As is usually the case, when you have scenes in registers on Egyptian monuments, you read from the bottom to the top. We naturally start at the top and go down, but in fact... Oh, sorry. Right, thank you. So we read from the bottom to the top. So what do we see here? Well, in the lower register of the stele, we can see a very large figure of a man with the head of a jackal with a huge spear, and he's spearing a crocodile that's in the water below, and fleeing from the crocodile is the small figure of a man. And that's our friend Patawerit. So at some stage in his life, Patawerit was in danger of being taken by a crocodile, something which in ancient Egypt was not uncommon. There were lots and lots of crocodiles in the Nile. Of course, that's not the case today anymore, where the high dam at Aswan has put an end to that, and you only find them further south into the Sudan. But Egypt was infested by crocodiles, and it wasn't unusual for people to be taken and killed by them. And Patawerit was in a situation like this, and in this situation, what he did was appeal to his particular god, the one that he particularly worshipped, who was the god Wepwawet, who is depicted in Egyptian iconography as a jackal or as a man with the head of a jackal. And here we see this representation of Wepwawet saving Patawerit from the crocodile. Now, of course, we don't need to think that this is what actually happened, that someone with a huge lance with the head of a jackal came and killed the crocodile. This is just a symbolic way of showing that he was rescued and that he attributed his rescue to the intervention of the god that he appealed to, namely Wepwawet. Now, there isn't very much text on this stele, but we know from similar monuments that the appeal to help was accompanied by promises made to the deity that would be fulfilled if the deity answered the prayer. And these promises included proclaiming the greatness of the deity as well. For example, on the stele of a man called Neb-Ra, who appealed to Amun to heal his son Amun-Nacht, in this text, Neb-Ra promises, "I will make for him adorations to his name. I will give him praises to the height of heaven and over the expanse of the earth. Recount his might to those fearing upstream and to those fearing downstream. Beware of him. Herald him to son and daughter, to great and small. Proclaim him to generation after generation not yet come into being. Proclaim him to the fish in the waters and to the birds in the air. Herald him to those who are ignorant of him and to those who know him. Beware of him." Our friend Patawerit also gives thanks to Wepwawet, his rescuer. In the middle register, we see him making an offering in private in the god's chapel. But as we saw in Neb-Ra's stele, in the text of Neb-Ra's stele, people also promised to proclaim to all the world how the deity had saved them. And this is what Patawerit is doing in the very top register, where he's probably recounting his experience and giving thanks to Wepwawet in the public arena, in the context of a procession of the god. Neb-Ra also vowed to dedicate a stele to Amun if his prayer was answered. I will make this stela to your name, and I will perpetuate for you these hymns upon it, should you rescue from me the draftsman Amonacht. That's what I said to you, and you heard me. Look, I have done what I said. And of course, the result is the stela, which unfortunately was lost in the Second World War. It was part of the Egyptian collection in Berlin. Now, if we understand the reliefs and texts recording Ramesses' Kadesh experience in this sort of context, it looks rather different. We aren't dealing with the work of a megalomaniac who falsely claims that a defeat was victory. Ramesses is recording a similar experience to that of Partaweret, on a much larger scale, of course. Like him, he found himself in a life-threatening situation. He appealed to Amon for help. Of course, in Ramesses' appeal, he doesn't say, I'll do all these things for you. He says, I've already done these things for you. So, you know, really, you should do a bit for me as well. So he appealed to his father Amon for help, and he believed that the timely arrival of the Na'arin, which turned the tide of battle for him, was the answer to his prayer. The repeated claim that Ramesses makes to have been abandoned by his army and left to fight alone, and the failure to mention the arrival of the Na'arin in the literary record, can probably also be seen as being motivated by the desire to emphasize the role that Amun played. His rescue was the work of Amun. But on another level, which for the ancients would have been seen as theological, or we'd probably interpret as ideological, what happened for Ramesses at Kadesh was indeed a triumph. On another scale, perhaps not on a military scale, but in another sphere. In the New Kingdom, an Egyptian king's legitimacy rested upon him being recognized as the chosen representative of the state god, who was always the sun god, who went by many names, Ra, Amun, or the composite Amun-Ra, or just Amun by himself. In the case of many kings, for example, Hatshepsut, Thutmose III, Thutmose IV, Horemheb, we actually have detailed accounts of how the individual was chosen by the god to be king. This is something that usually took place in the context of an oracle. The epithet that many kings bear, chosen one of the god, and then it's always a form of the sun god, the chosen one of Ra, the chosen one of Amun, the chosen one of Atum, and so forth, is often part of the name of the king. And of course, it's also included in the name of Ramesses II. Ramesses II's throne name was Usama-Ra, Setep-en-Ra, Usama-Ra, the chosen one of Ra. What happened at Kadesh was, for Ramesses, the ultimate proof that he was indeed Amun's chosen one. If Amun had had any doubts at all about it, he would have abandoned him. Instead, Ramesses survived Kadesh to become one of Egypt's longest reigning kings. 67 years he reigned. And he's a figure whom any visitor to Egypt, like the visitors to the exhibition, of course, encounters at every turn. Thank you.
This on? Yeah, it is. Well, that was pretty fascinating. This is exactly what I was hoping we were going to get into. And we're going to entertain any questions that you have in a minute, but I've been dying to ask one, so I'm going to start. So the Ramesses exhibition was curated by Dr. Zahi Hawass. And it has the stamp of approval from the Ministry of Tourism and Antiquity, is that what it's now called?
Yeah.
You told me that earlier. So it continues, in a sense, the long line of, I don't know if we want to use the word propaganda, but the long line of telling the story from the Egyptian point of view. And you can see this exhibition, you know, in there's a through line between the way that Ramses described his exploits all the way down to the year 2024. And here we are in Sydney watching a replay of those exploits from the Egyptian point of view. Now, it's not a complete glorification down in the exhibition, but it's a it has a certain slant to it. And I've always wondered, was there a Hittite slant? Was there a Hittite record? Was there a Hittite point of view that was published through another part of the sort of Syria-based or that part of the world that became popularly known as history for that part of the world that stands as an equivalent to the Egyptian story that we're entertaining today?
Well, no, in fact, there isn't. At least, not that we're aware of. I mean, the Hittites didn't build these temples like the Egyptians with these large surfaces that could be decorated with inscriptions and reliefs such as we have in Egypt. But we do. There is a record, or there are mentions of the battle in cuneiform texts on, you know, these clay tablets that the Hittites wrote on. And in those, it's very clear that they regarded the battle as being a victory for them. So although they didn't publicize it in the same way as Ramesses did with his reliefs, but they certainly considered it to be a victory. And of course, as I mentioned, when the treaty was concluded 15 years later or so, the boundary reflected that. You know, Egypt didn't take control of Kadesh. It lost Kadesh. The boundary was, you know, some way south of Kadesh. So, you know, tactically, it was a defeat. Strategically, I think it was, well, tactically it was a stalemate. Strategically, it was probably a defeat for Egypt. But for Ramesses himself, of course, he could see this in another way. I mean, he was almost killed, if not captured. And he managed to escape that. And so, you know, this must have been the most spectacular experience in his life, the most, the memorable experience that he ever had. And we know also from the reliefs that it's something that occupied him for a long time, because there are modifications made to the reliefs. There are changes. Unfortunately, It's really difficult to work out exactly what's going on and what these changes were reflecting, but you know, we know that alterations were made to the reliefs, so you know, it was something that was occupying him for quite a few years.
Well, and you mentioned that there would have been thousands of soldiers that were coming back to tell their own tales, and those tales got around the populace. And if Ramses was, for on one sense, doing, as you said, finding a way to display his loyalty to the god Amun, and that was so important to him, to make sure that was part of the story that was told, or maybe a primary part of the story. Was he also, do you think he was also publicizing another point of view that would act as a kind of answer to what might have been communicated amongst the people from the soldiers returning from the battle?
Well, that could have been. I mean, I'd love to know what they were talking about and their slant on the battle. I mean, there's always that possibility as well.
I'm speaking to you as if you were there, of course. So you could actually be able to tell me the actual story. I'm counting on you for that, you know.
Yeah.
Now, can I open the floor to some questions? We've got one up the back here. How are we going with mics, or just going to shout out loud? And I'll repeat it for you.
Look, I was wondering if you know terribly much about the subsequent campaigns of Ramesses in that area, Palestine.
Yeah.
So I'll just repeat the question, okay, so everybody can hear it. So the question is, is there any other stories or any other record of the subsequent campaigns? We saw on the map some of the campaigns, and some of them were located up in that area. And it's a very good question about what might have happened up there during that time.
Yeah. There's nothing like Kadesh. You know, any other sort of action was more sort of police action to keep things quiet. So there was no major opposition to Egypt, and there are no significant campaigns that he conducted after Kadesh. They had fairly good control of that part of the world for most of his reign. The rebellions that took place usually occurred at the end of a king's reign or at the beginning of another king's reign. We find that the kings regularly conducted a campaign in the first year of their reign into Syria, Canaan. And the reason for this was even if the local vassals and client kings didn't actually rebel, the treaty that the Egyptians had with them was always on a personal basis. So it was the ruler of the city-state X who went into a treaty relationship with Egypt and recognized Pharaoh as his overlord. And of course, at the death of Pharaoh, this had to be renewed with the new Pharaoh, because there wasn't this concept of the state. It was all personalized in Pharaoh himself. I mean, nowadays, states conclude treaties with one another, and who the prime minister or the president was is usually immaterial. When you have a new government, a succession of governments, the treaty is still valid and continues in force. But in ancient Egypt, it was all personalized. The relationship is between the individual rulers, and on the death of an Egyptian pharaoh, theoretically, the vassal was freed of his obligation, and that had to be renewed again. So we often find that the pharaohs would go on campaign in their first year. Perhaps sometimes the vassals thought that this might be a good idea to try and assert our independence, or it might just have been that he went up there to conclude these treaties with with the rulers. Yeah.
So the question is, why go into this level of expansion in the first place? Because, as you could see, it was far away from where the capitals of Egypt were at the time.
That's a good question, and the answer would be a very long one too. But I'll try and keep it short. In earlier periods, Egypt has always had relations with Syria, Canaan. It was an important source of raw materials, particularly timber in Phoenicia. Wine and olive oil and that sort of thing, and also slaves or personnel, people. And so Egypt always had this interest in the area, but they didn't, in the earlier periods, they didn't really have an empire as such. We don't have any evidence of Egyptian garrisons there, physically controlling the area. They would send campaigns into those areas to assert their interests, but it wasn't really an empire in the strict sense of the word. At the end of the so-called Middle Kingdom, Egypt had a period of internal weakness, and there were peoples from Syria, Palestine, particularly the lower parts of Canaan and so on, who migrated into Egypt over the years. This sort of thing had been happening throughout the Middle Kingdom as well. So there are large numbers of people from that part of the world in Egypt anyway. And at the end of the Middle Kingdom, these people whose origins were in Canaan, Syria, they gained control of Egypt and ruled the northern part of Egypt. These are the so-called Hyksos. You might have heard of them. And the Hyksos seem to have had a sort of a confederate structure. There was the great overlord, and then various other smaller kings who recognized him as the suzerain. And one theory is that the Hyksos king who ruled in Avaris in the Eastern Delta in Egypt, near where Ramesses later built his city of Ramesses, he was the overlord of a number of kingdoms that went up into that part of the world. And when the Egyptians then expelled the Hyksos and regained their independence from them, this role of overlord fell into their hands. And they saw themselves as the natural successors of the Hyksos with a claim to these territories in that part of the world. So that, you know, that's how they then, you know, the kings of the New Kingdom, they really try to assert their control there, and you know, eventually Egyptian garrisons and so forth were established there too. Although they tried to avoid too much of an investment of manpower in the area and depend on the vassal kings to do their bidding, but you know, they had a far more direct control of that part of the world, with a few garrisons here and there, and you know, Egyptian officials who were stationed in the city states and so forth to look after Egypt's interests there.
I had a little aha moment when we were down in the exhibition with Boyo and Suzanne, who's our scholar for our tomb talks on Tuesday. And we were looking at the coffin of Ramses II, which is wooden, and Suzanne said, you know, there was no wood in Egypt. Oh, no, I actually hadn't thought about that before. And it's a cedar coffin, so it probably came from Lebanon, as she said. Okay, and you mentioned wine and olive oil. There would have been all sorts of material that would have been a highly sought-after type of thing in trade, but
that's
also
right.
Being able to have that land might have made it easier to access those things.
That's right. And of course, there are also you know, valuable products that came through that part of the world that came from further east. If you think of lapis lazuli, for example, which, you know, one thing is from probably from Afghanistan, and it would have had to have come through that part of the world to get to Egypt. So, you know, Egypt had an interest in that part of the world for a long time.
There's heaps of lapis in the jewelry section of the exhibition as well.
Yeah.
Other questions?
A lot of the battle scenes that you have in Egypt have one part, so like hands and tongues and things for different techniques. This battle doesn't have that. Is that the shift in different representations? Or I'm just wondering why it hasn't got that sort of repetition of all the double tongues and the hands and things that other temples in Egypt do.
So a question is about representation of battles and the depiction sometimes in certain temples has used actual literal body parts, but it looks like from some of these drawings that that wasn't depicted here, and is there a reason for that?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Yeah, in the reliefs of one of Ramesses' successors, Ramesses III, you do find that. You know, there are representations of all the hands, the right hands that the Egyptians cut off the fallen enemies, or sometimes they cut off their penises as well, and they bring, you know, the soldiers would bring these and pile them up in front of Pharaoh after the battle, and presumably they were rewarded by the number of hands and things that they brought back. And you don't find that here. Well, I mean, I think the reason for it is that, you know, it wasn't an outright victory on the part of Ramesses. You know, it was a stalemate, and you know, he was dependent on Muwatallis, you know, not continuing the fight the following day and letting him withdraw, and so cutting off his soldiers' hands and other parts would not have been looked upon very, very kindly by Muwatallis. So it was a different situation. Whereas in the case of the battles of Ramesses III, I mean, that really was a total victory that Ramesses had over the sea peoples, for example, the Libyans and so on, and he was in a position to be able to do this sort of thing. With Ramesses, you know, he wasn't. Yeah.
Thanks for the talk. It's been great to get the context. It seems to me that Ramesses really had control of the narrative, or seemed to maintain that. How do you think he did that? What was the key things that he
So, the question, which is one of the ones that really has been one of mine, about how the narrative did get controlled and how he came to be able to be the principal storyteller of what happened during this time. It's always fascinated me. It's sort of to the victor goes to the spoils, but it's really to the best marketer goes the victory.
That's right. Well, I mean, he had no opposition in Egypt. You know, he was an absolute ruler. What he said went. He would have had, you know, a whole host of scribes and secretaries and so forth who actually wrote down what he said and composed the texts. We can see that quite nicely in the text as well, because you get these changes in pronoun. You know, Ramesses is talking in the first person, and yet sometimes he's referred to as His Majesty, which of course is what the scribes were writing. So, you know, he was working together with the scribes who actually put it all down on papyrus, and then eventually on the walls and so forth. And you know, he just had control over what of what was recorded. And I think that a lot of I think most people would have been quite happy with his interpretation of the events as well. So I don't think he would have had much opposition.
So everything was going well in the economy, so people were sort of happy.
As far as we know, in his reign, you know, Egypt was flourishing. It's not until sometime after his reign that we get reports of economic difficulties and incursions of Libyans and nomads from the east and so forth, plundering and so forth in Egypt. That doesn't happen until long after his reign. So in his period, things were fairly stable and secure.
It's interesting, if you take that same point of view, if anybody is watching or has watched the Shogun miniseries that's very popular right now on the Disney Channel, and it's a historical fiction, but it's a precursor to the other most famous battle in ancient history, the Battle of Sekigahara in Japan. And you can apply that same astute thinking about who controls the narrative to that battle as well. That's maybe another lecture series for a different exhibition. Other questions? Oh, what happened when the treaty came out? We're going to have a whole talk about that in a week and a half. But it's a good question. So, was there some sort of payment that was made, or some sort of tribute that had to be made as a result of the treaty?
No, the princess, the marriage was concluded after the treaty was concluded. So the treaty came first, and then some years later, Ramesses married the Hittite princess. Yeah, so it wasn't a condition of the treaty or anything like that. No. But it's interesting that it was always, you know, the traffic was always one way. It was always the foreign princesses who came to Egypt. It was never an Egyptian princess who was sent off to one of the, you know, to become one of the wives of one of the foreign rulers.
Funny how that worked out.
Yeah. I mean, and that's a long tradition too. It goes back, you know, hundreds of years before. Ramesses II, but the Egyptians never sent any of their daughters to become wives of the kings of the Near Eastern powers.
Hmm. I saw a hand over here.
Yeah. You had a map up there with the various groups that were supporting the Hittite king, but I noticed also that you had, it looked like the hieroglyphics for Crete and Cyprus.
That's right.
Places in Athens. Yeah. So was there a fair bit of interreaction between Egypt and those places? It's not really on the Battle of Kadesh as such, but are there records of that in Egypt itself?
Yeah, that's a good question. So in the map that showed the extent of how big the support for the Hittite Empire was, you saw Cyprus. I didn't see Athens as well, but it was quite a large region.
Into mainland Greece.
So what was the extent of that sort of cooperation, and how much interaction was there between the Egyptian empires and sort of these far-flung destinations?
Well, Egypt had very close relationships with all that part of the world. You know, going right back to the earlier part of the New Kingdom, and we have records in the tombs of Egyptian officials who were in charge of the administration of all the produce that was brought into Egypt from these countries. I mean, in the Egyptian record, it's sometimes referred to as being tribute, which is a bit misleading, and it's a problematic translation of the word that's used, because the word that's used is actually a participle of the verb to bring. So it's that which is brought. Now, of course, you could interpret that as being tribute, which, of course, is extracted from someone else without giving anything in return. But, of course, it can also refer to trade. And in most cases, what was going on was, in fact, trade. And, you know, we know from these records in the tombs of the officials who were involved with all this that, you know, they had ties with Minoan Crete and with mainland Greece, with the Mycenaeans, and, of course, with Syria, Canaan as well. So Egypt had very, very close economic ties with that part of the world for a long time.
It's all about the wine and the olive oil, I think.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, some of you might have heard of the famous Uluburun shipwreck off the coast of Turkey, which was loaded with produce, including Egyptian goods, which were probably being taken up there as exchange for the produce that they were bringing from down there. Mm.
Now, there was a hand behind you as well. Yes, go ahead. Yeah, so what was the actual significance of this battle outside the realm of Egypt, do you think?
Well, it would have been significant. I mean, as I said, the Hittites do refer to it. They haven't left the same sort of record that Ramesses did. But, of course, they were able to assert their position in that part of the world. They kept control of Kadesh. Egypt never got it back again. You know, it would have been a very significant battle for them as well. It's a shame we don't have more detailed information about it. It would have been nice if we could find a library of cuneiform tablets with Muwatallis' take on what happened. But it's pretty clear from what we do have that, as far as the Hittites were concerned, it was a Hittite victory. Yeah.
I think we have time for one more question. Okay, yep, go ahead.
Thank you. So you mentioned earlier that you were saying that the battle was likely a stalemate and in some regards the Egyptians a defeat, but Ramesses was saying it was a victory and he gave the reason as seeing that Amun had chosen him and like recognized him as for his do you think that was entirely politically motivated, or do you think Ramesses, on a personal level, actually thought of it as a victory because of that?
Oh, another question that assumes that the professor was there. Thank you. Same thing. So, when it finally comes down to it, and this is a good final question, in your opinion, do you think that this was motivated by a need to make that tribute to Amun and because that was so much part of the society at the time that it was so important, or was there an overarching political motivation that existed as well?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'd say more than political, I'd say it was a religious, theological motivation. I mean, I think Ramesses genuinely believed that, you know, his father Amun rescued him in his hour of need, and you know he I think you know the way I've tried to interpret his view of it, I think he genuinely believed that and held that view. He would have been, you know, we know from with other kings as well. Ramesses III, he actually wrote sort of the equivalent of a psalm addressed to the god Amun, in which he also expresses his devotion and love of the god. And I think, you know, we often forget that you know, for the Egyptians, these gods were realities. They were powers that they'd experienced in their lives, and it was a genuine emotion and feeling that they had for the gods. And I'm quite convinced that Ramesses had this feeling for his father Amun as well, and really did believe that, you know, he'd come to his rescue, and he saw this as a great affirmation of his position as being Amun's representative on earth to rule over Egypt.
We could continue this deconstruction of history for hours. It's absolutely fascinating. Unfortunately, we have to close because we found that there are people that have time tickets that attend these lectures that need to go into the exhibition afterwards. So I have to keep to time. But can we have a round of thanks for Boyo Okungo?
Well, thank you too, and for all your interesting questions. It's been a great interaction.
Yeah, fantastic questions. Thank you. It's very motivated and interested. So I want to thank everybody for coming today. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you come back to both see the exhibition or see one of the last few talks that we have, and then maybe come back for one of our future exhibitions. Thank you.
This has been an Australian Museum podcast.